Hello and welcome to Behind the Headlines. This is the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard all around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Brigham Young University quietly removes a section banning homosexual behavior from the online version of its honor code. Some supporters of the arts in Utah question the favoritism baked into ZAP tax funding. Planners look for solutions to traffic gridlock in the Cottonwood Canyons and more. And joining me for this conversation, we have Salt Lake Tribune Managing Editor David Noyce. Good morning and welcome, David.
Hi, Roger.
Also here is reporter Brian Maffley from the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for being here, Brian.
Yeah, thank you, Roger.
Good morning to you. And reporter Taylor Stevens, welcome and good morning to you.
Good morning.
Listeners, we invite you to join this discussion. If you have questions about any of the stories that we are covering today, call us at 801-355-8255. You can also tweet your comments and questions to us. Our handle is at KCPW. David Noyce, Brigham Young University made some news this week. For quite a while, the school's honor code has been under a certain degree of scrutiny, both on and off campus. One part of that honor code has to do with homosexuality, and it mirrors the tenets of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which owns and operates the school. That's why this week a change to the honor code caused quite the stir. What happened, David?
Yeah, you referred to it being quiet, but once it happened, it created a lot of noise.
Right.
The honor code for a while now has referred to homosexual behavior, and it has addendum to that, or had an addendum to that, saying that that amounted to all forms of physical intimacy that would give expression to homosexual feelings. And that was seen as holding hands, kissing a person of the same sex. That was removed without much fanfare. Once people noticed, though, then they started wondering, what exactly does this mean? Does this mean holding hands and kissing is okay? And a lot of students, LGBT students or their allies, went to the honor code office and asked. And they told us, they were told, it essentially does mean you holding hands and kissing would be okay on campus.
That's what the honor code office says.
That's what they told the students, according to the students.
Okay. Yeah.
BYU seemed to walk that back a little bit later, and I don't know if you want to talk about that now.
Well, what does the university, and I guess sort of more broadly the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, if they weigh in on this, changes at the honor code? Because this isn't just for BYU, for Brigham Young University. This is for all of the Brigham Young University campuses, right?
All five campuses that are under the BYU rubric, including BYU Pathway, which is a sort of worldwide online program.
So what does the university say?
Well, the university, basically, they just said that they had updated the handbook. And then later in the day, they said that there had been some misunderstandings, possibly, and that the principles of the honor code had not changed. It's hard to say whether that really clarified things for students or not, because I don't think people had a lot of questions about the principles as much as they did about what actions are or aren't permitted.
Right. I mean, the sort of the photograph in the Tribune that accompanied this story was of a girl kissing in front of the statue of BYU, her girlfriend. And am I right about that?
Saying that was her first gay kiss, I think she said yes.
And the question is whether or not that's admissible or allowable on
exactly.
BYU campus.
The Honor Code Office said that they would handle things on a case-by-case basis and kind of talk to students individually. So it's really early now to see exactly how this change is going to play out and whether it actually is going to amount to a change, some people wonder.
Hmm.
There is no doubt, though, that stipulation is no longer in the Honor Code, the actual printed version, whether it's online or wherever, of the honor code, which now actually does mirror more of the policy of the faith, the LDS Church, which owns the BYU. That was never actually part of the LDS Church's policy.
It was just in the school honor code. I mean, so we don't necessarily know what's driving this change to the honor code either. I mean, there's no, since we don't have a statement, an official statement from the church or from the university, we can't really glean what's happening there.
They haven't said this is why we did it, except to say, with the alignment of a new church handbook that came out this week, they're trying to closely align with that. However, as you said in your intro, there has been talk about this on and off campus for some time, and pressure has been building on BYU to do something about that stipulation. In last September, two scientific societies dropped job postings for jobs that were available at BYU, citing that reference on homosexual behavior, saying we just don't feel like our members would support this. We're going to drop your job postings. It's played out in athletic events. Gordon Monson of the Salt Lake Tribune has a column about that today. It's played out that. It may have been a factor in BYU not gaining entry into the Big 12. And you're seeing a lot of religious institutions across the country sort of change that higher ed institutions, Notre Dame, Baylor, two notable examples of schools that have adjusted their codes of conduct to try to fit more closely with the conferences they're in or the other schools they're competing with.
This code of conduct, the honor code, does prevent, I mean, aside from... There's chastity is sort of baked into the honor code, right? You are not allowed to have sex out of marriage or to
no sexual relations outside of marriage. Meaning, and in BYU's case defined as, and in the LDS Church's case defined as, marriage between one man and one woman.
Okay. So, I mean, I guess how common, this is a really strange question, but how common or how prevalent, you know, how often do you see heterosexual couples holding hands or kissing on Brigham Young University's campus? And, you know, I mean, there's an obvious sort of whether or not this is going to be allowed question. I guess we just have to wait and see, David.
You're wondering about the equitable aspect of that, right? I can't say I've spent a lot of time on BYU's campus recently, but I would be surprised if there's not hand-holding going on between heterosexual couples on BYU's campus, and a fair amount of kissing.
Other students or former students have said, look, if this policy was wrong in the first place and then you changed it, there should be some sort of an apology to accompany it, because, or an acknowledgement that the policy was wrong in the past and that they don't see that happening. Can you talk about that, David?
Yeah. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and a top leader in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has stated that the church as an institution doesn't apologize. Now, BYU is owned by the LDS Church, but it's not the LDS Church. So I think BYU has sort of made sort of apologies for some past things, especially in their handling of sexual assault cases and things like that. They have talked about how we made mistakes here, you know, we're trying to remedy that, and they have taken steps, as we've reported widely, the steps they've taken. Whether there'll be an apology for this, I'd be surprised.
Dave, you mentioned that this comes just as the church released some changes or a new handbook this week with updates to its policy on transgender people. And can you talk about that, those changes? They're sort of loosely connected to what's happening at BYU.
Yeah, BYU did cite that at least as one reason that they've updated theirs. The handbook is a sort of instructions, I guess, is the best way to put it, for members and their leaders, lay leaders. Of course, they have lay leadership in the LDS Church, as to how to govern the church. It outlines everything, how worship meetings should be conducted, to different positions on different what the church would consider issues or moral issues. And the thing that came out this week was Wednesday, the handbook. There used to be two handbooks. One handbook, one was just given to bishops and stake presidents, higher lay leaders in local areas. And then a handbook two, which was widely available, which was available online to anybody, which was given to other leaders in the church, lower-level leaders in local congregations. Now those two handbooks have been merged into one and all of it put online. So all those things are available for anyone to see, whether you're a member of the church or not a member of the church. And the church won a lot of praise for doing that on a transparency purposes. The thing that was put into the handbook that's new that you're referring to is the transgender issues, which wasn't in the previous handbook.
Okay.
Has an extensive section now on transgender issues, trying to give some clarity to where the church's positions are on some of these different things.
What I mean, the specific, there's some clarity, but it says that members who elect medical or surgical intervention to transition to the opposite gender or who socially transition that is to say dress as the gender they identify as or change their names or pronouns, will experience some church membership restrictions, but that they won't be excommunicated. Is it that had a member of the church gone through those processes before, or had identified as a member of the opposite gender, you know, of the gender that they weren't assigned at birth, that they would they would be excommunicated from
the church? Well, you know, the thing is, the previous handbook did not address transgender on that, so there really wasn't much guidance. One of the reasons that one of the Mormon authorities who was over developing the new handbook said that they addressed this issue was because they were getting questions from local leaders as to how do we handle this. You have zeroed in on a part that many in the transgender community are very disappointed in, if not outright angry about, that they would be subject to, and it doesn't say they might be, it says they will be subject to membership restrictions, which is new vernacular also in the handbook. The handbook has said that the church has done away with the term excommunication. Hmm. Now it's called withdrawal of membership.
Okay.
And disfellowshipment, which was a grade below excommunication, they were never really happy with that language, so they've now called that membership restrictions, which means that a local leader can take away some privileges. It might be the privilege of going to a temple or partaking of sacrament or communion or holding a church position or calling, it might be called, in this all-volunteer church.
What has the reaction been to this addition of language to the handbook? And, you know, both in the transgender, you know, members of the faith who are transgender, and you know, others within the faith.
In the transgender community, it was a little bit mixed at times. There are some support groups that were very grateful for having some clarity to some of these issues. Also, the handbook does emphasize and stress that transgender individuals are welcome at church. They may partake of communion or the sacrament, as members of the church would call it, that they're encouraged to actually come to church and participate. So there were people that were very grateful for that in the transgender community and outside of it. But that the stipulation you talked about the if you undergo medical procedures or socially transition, which could include just using a different pronoun, you might face or you will face some kind of membership restriction, or at least there's a possibility for that.
I mean, if you were we'll wrap up here in a minute. But if you were disfellowshipped or if you were facing those membership restrictions, could you still, you know, partake in sacrament and do the things that you just said would be possible? If you were transgender, but I mean, I guess, yeah, it seems like there's a contradiction there.
You would still be, there does seem to be, some people have pointed that they feel like there might be some, maybe not just contradictions, but contrasting messages maybe might be a better way to put it. Hmm. They certainly would still be welcome at church meetings. That's blanket. That's very much stressed. One membership restriction may be how you could participate at church. In other words, you may not be able to say a prayer, give a talk, teach a class, or partake of this communion or sacrament.
Hmm. David Noyce, managing editor with Salt Lake Tribune, is there anything else that you want to add before we head to our first break in the show and move on to other news from this past week?
Well, one of the interesting things in the transgender section is that this does cement into policy the views that were expressed by Dallin H. Oaks, the first presidency of the first presidency, Church President Russell M. Nelson's right-hand man, you could say, that he gave before the fall general conference that drew a lot of attention and some controversy. This does pretty much cement that view in place, that it says that a person's gender is defined as their sex at birth. There were a lot of observers, commenters, people within the church and without that doesn't necessarily hold that view from some of previous church writings, but this does put into place in the handbook that view.
Okay. A reminder to listeners that you can join us with your questions and comments. The number to call is 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is @KCPW. We're going to take our David Noyce, Senior Managing Editor. Thanks again for covering these stories. We're going to take our first break in the show, and next up we will turn to some candidate visits to Utah as we barrel towards Super Tuesday. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune Managing Editor David Noyce and reporters Taylor Stevens and Brian Maffley. It's our Friday morning news roundup. Again, you can call us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. Taylor Stevens, this week you covered some political doings in Utah. Democratic presidential candidates have been coming here by the dozens. I'm kidding. Utah is now in the crosshairs of these candidates because we have our primary coming up. Pete Buttigieg, Michael Bloomberg, Tulsi Gabbard, they are the latest. You were at the Bloomberg event yesterday in Salt Lake City. This was just a day after his appearance at a debate in neighboring Nevada. What was the tone of this event like, Taylor, and how many people were there?
Yeah, so he talked about Trump a lot, which is to be expected from these moderate candidates. We saw that at the Buttigieg event as well. There were about 500 people there, and I would say that it was short. He was, you know, as you said, coming right off of the debate stage in Vegas, and this was a morning event, started at 9 a.m. So he spoke for about 16 minutes. He made a few well-placed Utah jokes. He did not perform to, I think, many people's liking on Wednesday on the debate stage. And he characterized that experience as like being a Utah fan in Provo during the Holy War. Made a couple of other, you know, well-placed jokes about the state. But he talked a lot about Trump, as I mentioned. He also kind of tried to draw some comparisons between some of the more left-leaning candidates in the race, people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, tried to make the case to Utah voters that he is the candidate who is best able to form a broad coalition of Democrats and Republicans and independents necessary to beat Trump in November.
I have to ask, some pundits out there called his debate performance in Nevada, you know, lackluster, and I'm wondering if he addressed that in his you know, the debate itself in his comments here in Salt Lake City.
Not beyond that, you know, joke about being a Utah fan in Provo during the Holy War, but I think, you know, he did take some shots at his fellow candidates, his opponents, particularly those more, like I said, those left-leaning candidates.
Okay. Okay, so he's also, Bloomberg is spending a lot of money on advertising here in Mountain Salt Lake City in Utah, and that's kind of anomalous for a Democratic candidate in Utah, just because of the fact that Democratic candidates haven't won, or for president, haven't won in Utah for quite a while. How much money is he spending?
So he spent $2.23 million as of Wednesday afternoon, and that's according to 538. But, you know, the game has changed a little bit in Utah this year. This is our first year as a Super Tuesday state. Mm-hmm. Our caucuses and primaries used to be later on in the campaign season, and there wasn't much reason for people to think too much about Utah. So we have seen many more visits from presidential candidates, and as you mentioned, there are more to come ahead of Super Tuesday on March 3rd.
He wants those delegates for
right.
to try and secure the Democratic nomination, so
exactly.
He's spending heavily. But he also talked about this thing that hasn't been done for a long time, which was the concept of turning Utah blue.
Right, and Pete Buttigieg mentioned this as well, and Utah hasn't had a Democratic nominee for president since Lyndon B. Johnson in 1964. Both candidates say, you know, they're the one who's going to do it. Interestingly, Tom Steyer, another fellow billionaire, is the only other candidate who's made ad buys in Utah. His quite a bit less, to the tune of about $17,000. So while there are candidates who are coming here, they're not investing heavily in ad buys at this point.
That is a huge difference between those two numbers in terms of how much money is being spent. We also had, well, actually, who was at Bloomberg's event? And then we'll turn to other candidate visits. But, you know, what was the sort of crowd makeup like?
Yeah, I talked to some interesting folks who'd come up from BYU. They were students at Brigham Young University. And I was talking to them, and I kind of made the comment that you don't really expect to see, you know, students from BYU drive up to Salt Lake City to support a Democrat. And they talked about, you know, feeling like they're disaffected Republicans. They don't really have a place to go. This is their first time sort of thinking about voting for a Democrat, and they're kind of looking for a candidate who they can live with because they're not behind Trump.
Okay, that's the question I was going to ask.
Yeah. But there were also, you know, older voters there as well who really like Bloomberg. I talked to a woman who really admires that he's just putting every dollar he has into trying to defeat Trump. And she likes his record as a former New York City mayor, thinks that he has a lot more experience than the current president does. And you know, was impressed. You know, nobody really acted like they were too impressed by his debate stage presence on Wednesday night. However, they were willing to overlook that because they see that he has other qualifications they feel are important.
Like $64 billion. it's just a comment. And again, you can't really do the kind of ad buys that that he's doing unless you have this giant wallet. And he's basically funding his whole campaign.
Yeah, which he's raises, not taking any donations.
Which raises all sorts of interesting questions. And maybe you have some of those questions. Listeners, the number to call is 801-355-8255. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporters from the Salt Lake Tribune. And you can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg had a rally this week. It was a bigger rally than the one that you attended yesterday, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, so my colleague Lee Davidson was there, and he reported there were about 4,500 people there, people who had lined up, you know, 6 or 7 hours in advance of this event to see the mayor come. It's also probably worth noting this was Buttigieg's first appearance in Utah. Bloomberg, that was his second in-person appeal to voters, so maybe that had something to do with the number of people who came out. Also, I think evening rallies are maybe a little bit easier for people to attend than, you know, a 9 a.m. start of the workday event. But yeah, good turnout for Mayor Buttigieg on President's Day. Salt Lake City Mayor Erin Mendenhall was there. She gave Buttigieg a surprise endorsement on the stage. He, too, talked a lot about beating Trump and trying to kind of unify the party around a candidate, which is important as we've seen kind of the moderate candidates splitting a lot of votes at this point.
You mentioned that endorsement. There were some other endorsements for Pete Buttigieg here in Utah. Who are we talking about?
Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill, County Mayor Jenny Wilson, and her father, former Salt Lake City Mayor Ted Wilson, have all endorsed Buttigieg.
Okay. And then there have been some other visits earlier in the campaign season. We saw former Vice President Joe Biden had an event here, also
close to the public. Yeah, I was at Elizabeth Warren's campaign event, and I believe that was in April of last year, so pretty early on in the cycle.
Hers was open to the public.
Hers was. Michael Bloomberg has had two events, and then Tulsi Gabbard will be here today at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. She has a couple of events scheduled this weekend, including a snowboard with Tulsi event at Snowbird.
Okay. Last time around, back in 2016, we had a different way of operating basically how we chose our primary candidates. We had a caucus, huge turnout for that caucus, some voting hiccups, but the overwhelming number of those who were participating in the Democratic primary in that caucus went with Senator Bernie Sanders, right?
Yes, yeah, 77% of the vote in 2016, and Sanders is a candidate again. So it'll be interesting, I think, on Super Tuesday to see how the votes break out this time around. But we are, you know, we'll be doing a lot of coverage for Super Tuesday, March 3rd, and we'll see if Bernie Sanders comes to Utah ahead of those elections.
And voting is already underway, correct? I mean, there's mail-in ballots that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then just to clarify, the Democratic primary is an open primary, meaning people who are not members of the Democratic Party can participate in it?
Yeah, that's correct.
Except that you have
Oh, wait, hang on. David Noyes, go ahead.
Sorry. You have to, if you're unaffiliated, you have to request a Democratic ballot. That would be the one caveat. So if you're unaffiliated, you can request a Democratic ballot without actually affiliating. The Republican, you have to actually affiliate with Republican.
There will also be in-person opportunities for voting as well.
Okay. We have a comment from somebody who called in that I'm not certain we can answer this, but Karen from Salt Lake City called in, didn't stay on the line, but left a message asking us to review the Electoral College rules and explain why a Democratic vote from Salt Lake City doesn't really matter. Does anybody want to take a stab at that?
Well, it matters. They just haven't been able to capture those electoral votes from Utah.
I mean, this is for the
fall election.
The fall election, not for the
general election.
Right. Mm-hmm. Whereas in this primary, obviously, it matters.
Matters for delegates, and it matters beyond. I mean, Utah doesn't have a great vast number of delegates. It's not California. Yeah, it's not Illinois, but any election victory you can get gives you a bounce of some kind. You can point to a victory, which may help in fundraising for those who aren't Michael Bloomberg and need the money. Mm. So, you know, there are advantages there just by beyond the delegate count, especially this early on still.
I mean, the Electoral College is an interesting can of worms to try and open right now. But there are instances in which the superdelegates make choices that go in counter to the vote of the people of a given jurisdiction or state, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we don't have to dig into it right now, but Karen, we'll do our best at some point. Listeners, again, you can call 801-355-8255 or tweet to us at KCPW with your questions and comments, and we'll try and answer them. We are going to turn now, though, to other... Taylor Stevens, thanks very much for covering these political stories. And again, this is our weekly recap of local news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. You are invited to weigh in, 801-355-8255. I want to bring in a different voice now and turn to a completely different topic from this past week's news, and that is Brian Maffley, a reporter with Salt Lake Tribune, and the question of the future of the Cottonwood Canyons, big and little, home to ski resorts and climbing and hiking and other outdoor recreation. Wednesday, you attended a forum on the issues that those canyons are being confronted with because they are getting kind of loved to death. Brian Maffley, what was this forum about? Maybe just tell us, who was in attendance and what they were trying to address.
Okay, Roger. The Salt Lake Tribune hosted that forum, and it was very focused on the transportation issues. The gridlock, traffic congestion in the canyon is seen as probably the number one challenge these days. And planning and studies and quest for solutions has been going on for 30 years at least, and yet hardly anything has been initiated in any kind of comprehensive way. And of course, we have lots of things on the edges over the years, but nothing concrete. And it's part of the problem is it's hard to find a consensus that people can live with. Do we want to make our roads bigger? Do we want to have big infrastructure, right, rail? Or do we want to make people take the bus or what? So it's hard to find a consensus. So I think that's one of the reasons why our editor, Jennifer Napier-Pierce, agreed to host Wednesday's forum at the library. And we invited Dave Fields from Snowbird, Carl Fisher, environmentalist with Save Our Canyons, and Ralph Becker, our former Salt Lake City mayor, who is now executive director of the Central Wasatch Commission.
Right.
Three important voices. It would have been nice to also have had someone from the Utah Department of Transportation and Utah Transit Authority available to address the questions raised by this audience, because so much of what people are interested in are what changes those agencies have in store for addressing this what's now a crisis.
Yeah, I mean, there's this interesting stat in your article on the topic of crisis. The two canyons, Big Cottonwood and Little Cottonwood Canyon, see more visitors each year than all of five Utah's of all of the five, you know, the mighty five national parks in Utah combined. That was a surprising stat.
Yeah, it is interesting. So there's about 9 million visitors in these canyons of the Uinta Wasatch Cache National Forest. Of course, there are these beautiful canyons right outside of Salt Lake City, extremely easy to get to. They've become a year-round recreation destination, obviously in the winter because we have four big ski areas there. Yeah. And it is a big part of Utah's brand. And that's why this is important for the whole state.
Yeah. But congestion, gridlock, bad traffic in the winter. I want to get to some of the, there were some during this forum that, again, as you said, the Tribune hosted, there were some high cost solutions that were presented. There were some not so high cost options to try and tackle this. What were we looking at?
Well, what's underway now is that the UDOT is looking at a plan for Little Cottonwood Canyon. And part of, on that list of options are big-time road improvements that would make the ability to drive up and down the canyons more efficient and easy. And that would include, these $100 million, quote-unquote, snow sheds to protect the road under kind of key avalanche slide areas. A gondola hundreds of millions of dollars, and then the biggest ticket item of them all would be rail.
Right. And that would basically replace roads? The rail would just, or would it be in addition?
Yeah,
to?
Well, there's already, it would probably be in addition. There's already rail beds from the mining era in Little Cottonwood Canyon, but if you have a rail go up Little Cottonwood Canyon, you might as well dig a tunnel and have it go to Big Cottonwood. And then maybe all the way to Park City. If you're going to spend $1 billion, you may as well go the distance.
Get your money's worth.
The criticism of those projects, though, and Carl Fisher raised this pretty well, is that, you're just kind of pushing the problem of canyon congestion down to the mouths of the canyon where you have to build, massive infrastructure down there in Cottonwood Heights, 5,000 car parking structures. The environmentalists would like to just see, hey, we've got the infrastructure to support buses. Let's just do what we can to encourage the use of bus transit. We already have a wintertime service. Why not make it year-round? Basically put a costly price on driving up the canyon, especially if you're in your car alone.
Hmm. And would that cost be, I guess it's anybody's guess, but the cost could be as you enter the canyon, sort of toll booth, or there are some, of course, some resorts, right, or one resort right now has a fee on parking.
Yes, and it's an interesting fee, and that's, we're referring to Solitude there. But let's talk about the tolling idea first.
Sure.
So that's been kicked around and studied by two University of Utah groups. One looked at Little Cottonwood, one looked at Big Cottonwood, and they came up with some proposals to have a toll sliding depending on how many people are in the car, as a way to discourage private automobile use and raise revenue to fund other improvements. And that's one way. The other way is to, charge for parking. Solitude embraced that idea this winter. It didn't go over very well with some of their season pass holders who felt like there was a bait and switch. However, it came out in Wednesday night's forum that, according to Dave Fields, who's closely monitoring what's going on over at Solitude, that it's really having the desired effect. The cars parking at Solitude came with three or more people. If you come up by yourself or just two people in the car, you're charged $20 to park at Solitude. It's only $10 or $5 if you have two or one, three or four people in your car.
Mm-hmm.
So they've created this incentive, and it seems to be working. And then he contrasted that with what goes on in Little Cottonwood Canyon, and he says, there's still tons of people, skiers coming up the canyon with one person in the car, and that's just not that's never going to work. And so I get the feeling that everybody's going to go to paid parking in the, maybe not next season. Dave Field said, no, we're not going to do it next year, but we're considering it strongly. And I think in the next couple years we're going to see tolling and we're going to see paid parking at the ski areas.
I want to just go back to one thing that you mentioned, which was the suggestion of a gondola. Something sort of similar has been suggested in the past to connect the various resorts together, but that was less of a transportation plan than it was a kind of chairlift
that
concept.
That was more,
right?
More tying the seven, well, now six ski areas, now that Park City and the canyons have consolidated, tying the major Wasatch ski areas together, and they're all basically, they're all almost touching, and to join them with a few lifts would be a very simple matter. And that was, that solution or that idea was pushed with the One Wasatch concept about 10 years ago. And that was kind of pitched as a transportation solution in a way to get people from one side of the Wasatch, Park City side, to the Cottonwood side without having to drive. But a lot of people, especially backcountry skiers and environmentalists, they're deeply opposed to that idea. They feel like it's going to industrialize the mountains and just make it too easy for resort skiers to get into backcountry terrain that is enjoyed by people who like to hike.
Yeah, who like to spend the effort to get there. David Noyce, managing editor, you look like you have something to say here.
I was at the forum, too, with Brian. It was interesting. I think one of the things that, Brian, you talked about the buses, I think that they gave a statistic that the buses, which are running more frequently this ski season, like every 15 minutes, the ridership's up, like, what, 35 to 40% over the same time last year?
That's what... That's what
they reported.
Yeah, those are preliminary numbers, but that is that is stunning to me that so far this year, bus ridership, and it looks like both canyons, up 35 to 45%. Now, a lot of that could be driven by Solitude's parking fee. I know I'm taking the bus to Solitude this winter. And so, yeah, having increased frequency of bus probably makes a huge difference there. You know, another thing that I think that people in that audience, there's about 200 people came, they applauded this, was this idea of when the canyons are congested and the cars are at a standstill, get a police escort for the buses to go up the canyon, give them the priority, give those buses the priority to get up the canyon first. And I think that that's an interesting idea. I haven't, and people really responded well to that one.
Right, and that's obviously, again, just using the extant infrastructure and not having to do any investment. Was there anybody sort of advocating at this forum for those bigger ticket items?
Yeah, I think Dave Fields is enamored with the gondola idea, and it turned out we did a little research in this. When Snowbird was built in the early 70s, you know, gondola up the canyon was, or a tram rather, was part of the idea. It didn't actually ever happen. But this idea that the road up Little Cottonwood Canyon is really tricky has been well known for many years. It's very steep. It gets lots of snow on it. And as a result, it's on those snowy days that coincide with weekends. It's a real hassle getting up and down the canyon, and
then you add avalanches to the mix, and
road closures, and then you know, tourists in rental cars with two-wheel drive sliding off the road. Believe me, you know, everybody I know has been spent 5-6 hours stuck in Little Cottonwood Canyon at some point in the last winter or two.
Where does this go from here? I mean, there's this forum, conversations about what the future might hold. How does this get to the next steps?
Well, UDOT has to complete its study this year. The Central Wasatch Commission has its own study looking more broadly at the Central Wasatch, not just one canyon. And once these plans are complete, some decisions have to be made on which investments to pursue, and they need to happen. And but it's basically we're in kind of...
holding pattern.
It's a bit of a holding pattern. Now, what we've seen, we've seen lots of improvements in the canyons over the last couple of years, but they're incremental. You know, they have these high T intersections where the ski area entrances are with the two highways. Those have made, you know, more efficient for cars to get in and off on and off the highway. The bus service has obviously changed somewhat to make it more efficient. But those are, you know, that's picking around the edges. Solitude's paid parking thing. What's really needed are some, you know, a major plan being initiated and fulfilled. And I think some decisions are going to be made in the next year about how to do this.
Last question before we head to a break. Public comment on this? I mean, when can the public weigh in? They've done it a little bit on say, the big... project.
So the UDOT plan has already, the public comment period on that has come and gone, but when they release a final environmental impact statement on that, there will be an opportunity for people to weigh in, and that I think will be sometime later this year. There's a public comment period open now for the Central Wasatch Commission study, which just opened this month.
Okay.
And you have till March 1st to weigh in on that.
Okay. A quick comment here from Chris from St. George, who says, thinks that a rideshare shack at the bottom of the canyons is a good idea. People can hop in cars going up the mountain, sort of like a hitchhiker situation. And so if you've got room, you would take people up and maybe save on parking fees.
Yeah, that definitely is going on as
that's
well.
That's happening.
Yes, that's already happening. Yeah. Thanks for your comment, Chris. Listeners, we need to take another break on the show. You were listening to Brian Maffley. Thanks very much for your reporting on this. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Still more to come, including some questions about the ZAP tax funding, plus our underplayed stories of the week. This is, again, Behind the Headlines. We'll be right back.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's David Noyce, Brian Maffley, and Taylor Stevens. It's our Friday morning news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Weigh in on what you've been hearing by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Taylor Stevens, some supporters of the arts here in Utah are raising questions about the ZAP tax. This is funding that is specific to arts organizations in the state, sort of, that came from a ballot measure, I believe. Actually, before we jump into the story, maybe you can just tell us what the ZAP tax is, and then we'll get into those questions that are being raised.
Sure. It's a little confusing. So what it is the Utah legislature has created a framework for counties of a certain class to take this idea to their voters of raising sales tax to support the arts. So Salt Lake County did this in 1996, went to the ballot, voters approved it, and have approved it ever since in a pretty wide margin. What we were interested in looking at, though, is ZAP, you know, there's millions of dollars, taxpayer dollars at play in this program. And we felt that, you know, there should be a little bit of scrutiny as to kind of where those dollars are going. So we did an analysis of the last 20 years of kind of where all of the money is going and found that there are a few organizations, these large organizations, that are really taking the majority of the money from this. And that's because of some things that are built into the state code. So these big arts organizations have 45% of the total on lock for per state law. And so the Utah Symphony has kind of been the biggest beneficiary of this.
How much, what percentage do they, I guess, yeah, who are the big organizations that benefit from, that most, that in the biggest way benefit from the ZAP tax?
Yeah, so the Symphony Opera has received nearly $51 million since 1997 when this passed. And what's interesting is there's a smaller tier of arts organizations, the smaller ones that don't have as big of budgets. And those ones are competing for a much smaller slice of the pie. They have 9% of the overall funds allocated to them. And the Symphony and Opera have received more money each year than all of the small arts organizations combined. So in 2017, there were nearly 200 organizations that were kind of jockeying for this money, and the Symphony and Opera alone got more than all of them. So these conditions have sort of prompted some in the arts world to wonder, you know, should there be some tweaks to this math that determines who gets the funds to, you know, make it a little bit more equitable so that some of these arts organizations that are reflecting the diversity of Utah's changing population have a little bit more support, and organizations that are a little bit more established, that are, you know, for right or wrong, better for worse, seen as a little more elitist, that are able to stand on their own easier, that, you know, the public kind of backs off supporting them a little bit in favor of some of these larger groups, smaller groups, excuse me.
Is there, I don't know how in-depth you went into this, but the sort of background behind why this was baked into the ZAP tax, why these organizations, somewhat larger organizations, were getting as much funding as they were?
Yeah, the Symphony and Opera were the big, you know, advocates for this framework back when it was first created. They were lobbying the Utah legislature to, you know, they'd run a deficit for 8 years straight. They'd raided endowment funds. Their major donors were tapped out. So they came to the state and said, you know, you've got to kind of help us. We are not going to survive. So they lobbied. The state created this idea, but it wasn't very popular with Utah voters. And it was only when they added parks, pools, you know, county recreational facilities that voters really got on board.
And the zoo?
And the zoo. Hmm. And so that, you know, I think shows some of the voter intent behind ZAP, that they really want to, you know, support the aggregate, support more broad coalition. Of course, the Symphony and the Opera and some of these larger arts organizations say that it makes sense and it's fair for them to get a larger slice of the pie because they have a bigger economic impact on the state than some of these small organizations do. The basic way that all of this works is that the more money you spend as a large arts organization, the more you get. And so the big spenders are getting more taxpayer dollars.
We're kind of running low on time, and I want to. There's a comment from somebody in Salt Lake City who has a comment on this that I want to bring in before we have to basically wrap this up kind of quickly. And so I will just try and drag him in now. David from Salt Lake City is on the line. And David, are you there? Wait, hold on. David, are you there? Maybe not. Hold on. Let's try this one more time.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
Hello.
Yes, David. Yes, great. What you've got a comment about the ZAP tax funding structure. What's your comment?
Yes, I do. And if I may quickly comment about a previous story, not just unaffiliated voters can vote in the Democratic primary, but in Utah, those registered with other parties can choose to vote in the Democratic primary instead. But about what I wanted to say about ZAP was, I think it's time that we remove the Z from ZAP because, of course, looking at depressed animals in cages is really separate and demeaning to true arts organizations, and it really brings down the reputation and I think the support for it.
Okay.
Because they're such separate things, and it's really time to actually separate them. If people want to vote for, you know, again, wild animals captured and, you know, Googled at by slackjawed humans, great, go for supporting that. But don't link it with the ballet, with the opera, with film, with the symphony, so many
great,
majestic art.
Great. David, thank you very much for your comment. And we're running low on time, so I'm going to let you go, but we appreciate it. And for the clarification on the primary, you have to choose to vote in one or the other, but still... True. You can be with other. Anyways, let's take his comment really quickly. David from Salt Lake City talking about separating the Z from the Zoo Arts and Parks. Is anybody suggesting that right now, other than David?
That's outside the scope of this reporting, which really looked at arts. So we didn't really focus much on the recreation or the zoo. This is looking at large arts groups and small arts groups. No one I've heard is advocating for that.
Taylor, I'm so sorry that we didn't save enough time for this story to go as in-depth as we ought to, but you know, what else do we need to know before we head to our final segment, the Underplayed Stories of the Week?
Yeah, I guess the last thing I would say is that while there are some people who believe this math should be tinkered with, there is a sizable portion of those in the arts community who worry that, you know, putting this before the legislature would gut funding for all of the arts organizations, and they believe that, you know, those conversations should happen within the arts community and not during debate at the state legislature.
Basically, this is a delicate balance, and you risk upending the apple cart or whatever.
Right.
All right, well, check out Taylor's reporting in the Salt Lake Tribune, as well as all the stories we've been covering at sltrib.com. Right now, though, we need to turn to our Underplayed Stories of the Week, our final segment of the show. And Taylor, we'll stick with you if you're ready.
Sure. So I want to highlight a story from my colleague Bethany Rogers. She wrote about Utah legislative leaders sending President Donald Trump a citation letter commending his policies' effects on Utah. And this comes after U.S. Senator Mitt Romney was the only Republican to vote to remove the president during the impeachment process. So as that dust settles, Utah leaders want to send a message that they back the president and his policies.
And also there was a bit of talk about censuring Senator Romney for that vote from the Utah legislature. That's not happening anymore, though, as far as we know.
I think they've decided to send this positive message in lieu of that one, but, you know, nothing's off the table until it's over.
Right. Okay. That's Taylor Stevens' pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. Brian Maffley, how about you? What do you got?
I have so enjoyed Nate Carlisle's coverage of the trial of the... involving the Washakie renewable energy scam, the depravity and the waste of money that went into the Kingston family's abuse of the renewable energy tax credit is amazing. And fortunately, that trial has two more weeks of
more enticing and fascinating reporting from Nate Carlisle on this. It really has been Hollywood worthy. It's fascinating. Check it out. SLTrib.com. Great pick, Brian Maffley. Thanks. David Noyce, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
Provo has approved brew pubs in two sections of downtown and at two of their shopping center areas. Essentially, restaurants are able to beer brew at their on site. This is something that hasn't happened in Provo since before Prohibition. Now, there's no brew pubs poised ready to open in those areas in Provo. The vote was, by the way, 4-3 in the city council, so it narrowly passed. But they expect some to come, and also they have to work out some licensing issues still and things like that. But that's a change. And, of course, if BYU students went to a brew pub and partook of those beverages, that would definitely still be against the honor code. So,
interesting pick, allied to the story that we were talking about earlier today from David Noyce, managing editor with the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm going to go with kind of an odd one. There's a bill that would make it a Class B misdemeanor for someone to willfully not call the police when they witness an emergency, say a wreck or an attack. It's one that Representative Brian King has been running unsuccessfully for a number of years now, and you can add 2020 to the list of unsuccessful years because it failed on the House floor. And the argument made that seemed to sort of seal the fate of this bill was one made by Grantsville Republican Representative Merrill Nelson, who invoked the parable of the Good Samaritan in the Bible, a speech by Latter-day Saint leader Dallin Oaks, the writings of John Adams, and the behavior of Houston Astro third baseman Alex Bregman. I don't think the Tribune covered this, but you should check out the committee audio if you can. It was really entertaining and made me question, you know, what seminar I had signed up for when I attended that. Everything else we've been covering is in the Salt Lake Tribune. Taylor Stevens, David Noyce, and Brian Maffley, all with Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining us on Behind the Headlines this morning.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Behind the Headlines is a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. You can find podcasts at kcpw.org or through your podcast app. Thanks, as always, to Operations Director Jesse Ellis and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan for their help. Twitter and Facebook and other places are where we can be found. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week.